Are you feeling overwhelmed by hormonal changes? If you're a woman, you're not alone. With over 1,000 hormone disruptors in our environment, it's no wonder things can feel out of balance. On top of that, natural changes like PMS, menopause, and other life stages can leave you feeling tired, irritable, and trapped in a constant battle with your body. But here's the good news. You don't have to suffer through it. Hormone Harmony by Happy Mammoth is here to help. This herbal formula fine-tunes your hormones, balancing estrogen, testosterone, and even stress hormones like cortisol, which can contribute to weight gain, racing thoughts, poor sleep, and more. With over 40,000 five-star reviews and a bottle selling every 24 seconds, the results speak for themselves. Ready to feel like yourself again? For a limited time, get 15% off your first order at happymammoth.com using code NEXTCHAPTER at checkout. Visit happymammoth.com today and get your old self back naturally.
Check engine light on? Take the guesswork out of your check engine light with O'Reilly Veriscan. It's free. Ask for O'Reilly Veriscan today.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
The old world is dying. The new world struggles to be born. Now is the time of monsters. With those words from Gramsci, I welcome you to the Time of Monsters podcast, sponsored by The Nation magazine and widely available on all podcasting platforms. Today, I want to take up one of the great monster hunters of our time, Noam Chomsky, who is in the ninth decade of his life and has been ill for some time and is really no longer a public voice, but has been a monumental figure going back many decades, at least to the 1960s in terms of foreign policy, and in terms of linguistics, actually going back to the 1950s, when his famous review of B.F. Skinner basically revolutionized the study of language. Chomsky has been a great critic of American foreign policy. And in the pages of The Nation, my guest, Danny Vesner, reviewed what will probably be Chomsky's last book. And we'll talk a little bit about that. And like surveying, you know, both Chomsky's monumental achievement, but also some of the limits of the sort of prescriptions Chomsky has offered for changing American foreign policy. So Danny Vesner, friend of the program, has been on before, is, I just noticed, the Henry Jackson professor at the University of Washington.
I'm in the Jackson School. I'm the Pyle professor in the Jackson
School. Oh, yeah, okay, yeah, yeah. Okay, but you are associated with Scoop Jackson, which has an element of irony, which maybe we can get into, or is very pertinent to our subject, actually. The power of that Scoop Jackson vision within the Democratic Party. But anyways, I want to welcome Danny on the program. And maybe get started with both his book. And I think, you know, we can start with Chomsky's achievements, which I think have to be honored.
Sure. Yeah. So thank you, Jeet, for having me. And of course, everyone check out the podcast, which is also sponsored by The Nation that I do, American Prestige. And subscribe at AmericanPrestigePod.com if you like what you hear. But Chomsky, as you said, is a monumental figure in two fields. He's a monumental figure in the history of linguistics and his, I believe it's universal grammar.
Yes.
Correct, which is this notion that was introduced by him in the 1950s when he was a young professor at MIT after he had worked he was from Philadelphia. He did his BA and PhD, I believe, at the University of Pennsylvania. He becomes a fellow at the Harvard Society of Fellows, and then he becomes a professor at MIT, which he basically stayed at until the very end of his career, where I believe he moved to Arizona. He introduced this concept of universal grammar. It really revolutionizes the field of linguistics. For years, I've been kicking around a paper about, you know, how this Chomsky developed that idea through this Jewish cosmopolitan notion that I think is actually really crucial to understanding a lot of mid-century Jewish intellectuals. But
very interesting, because his father was also a bit of a linguist, but actually in the opposite.
A Hebrew scholar.
Yeah, which is the sort of classic sort of tradition of philology, which one can associate you know, going back to the 19th century with a certain type of nationalism, an emphasis on the
Eliezer Ben Yehuda is a man, is a linguist who is traditionally associated with developing modern Hebrew, which is not which combines elements of Semitic grammar, but is really, really Indo-European in its structure to a significant degree. And Chomsky grew up a cultural Zionist. He says he grew up a cultural Zionist, and he claims that this net didn't mean colonization and occupation, but it meant sort of a Chad Ha'am, who was a famous figure at the time, you know, sort of look, you know, embracing elements of Jewish identity connected to Israel in a cultural sense. I haven't actually looked into it. I'm curious to the degree to which Chomsky is rewriting history or not rewriting history.
Well, there were non-occupation
he did go, elements to
He did. I mean, there was a sort of cultural Zionism, which was ostensibly like much less imperialistic in intent than both the sort of, especially labor Zionism
for sure,
and you know, obviously revisionist Zionism. And Chomsky did live in a sort of kibbutz in the early 50s. And I actually, I think that was actually my understanding from his sort of autobiographical comments, is that it was a disillusioning experience that, you know, he saw very close at hand. This sort of
One would really have to go to the archives. People, I mean, especially Chomsky is going to be rewriting that if it wasn't the case. Yeah. So I was like, okay, let's see. Okay. I think you have to go read the papers.
Yeah, but
I think they are available and they are massive. I've considered writing this on Chomsky. I'm like, oh man, I don't want to sit in archives for 20 years.
But I mean, to go back to the linguistic point, I mean, I do actually think it's interesting that the father came out of, you know, which, you know, within linguistics, there's these two different strands, the sort of very particularist, you know, associated with sort of nationalism of philology, which his father came out of, and what we could call the sort of structuralist approach to language, of seeing language on a more universal level, trying to understand all languages.
More quote-unquote scientific level,
on a scientific
level. Which is, this is the big move in the mid-20th century. Yeah. As the Cold War university is being built, you kind of have to claim your discipline as a science if you want that money. And Chomsky was very instrumental in that process. And I'm sure he believed it.
It was a big revolution, you know, like throughout the human sciences, and had a huge, I mean, the sort of impact, you know, going back to Saussure, you know, early 20th century, but it really took off in the 50s of trying to think of language on a more scientific level, on a more universal level, which I think has political implications as well, to actually think that like this is a universal human trait, language acquisition, rather than, you know, be focused on the study of particular languages. It had like wide, I mean, Chomsky, one reason he had such a wide influence was that the, you know, this sort of structuralist turn, this scientific turn, was all throughout the humanities and social sciences, in, you know, literary theory, in the sort of anthropology of Levi Strauss, in, you know, Foucault. I mean, it was and Chomsky was very much, you know, even though he was very, I think rightly hostile to many of the other figures in that movement, the sort of, you know, French post structuralist and post-structuralist, he was also part of that.
I mean, it's funded by the Ford Foundation. There's this big move to put basically, it's funny, use human science as a very old term, or what was called the behavioral sciences, and what generally is just today referred to as the social sciences on a more scientific footing. And again, one would have to go back and see like who was funding Chomsky. I bet the Ford Foundation money was in there.
Oh yeah, no, you know, no, there was some sort of Pentagon interest actually in funding his early research, because they had the idea that you could come up with a language translation machine. And I guess early thoughts of what we now call AI. And Chomsky was actually like, you know, basically came to the very early on the right argument about this, which is that you could get a translating machine just in the brute sense of like something, a computer powerful enough that could, like, you know, take elements of one language and figure out how it works in another. But that machine itself would not be artificial intelligence. It would not understand anything that it's translating. It would be a sort of just a brute mechanical exercise, which is the translation machines that we have now. The MIT context is actually very important. I mean, for mentioning this, because MIT was the Cold War university. you know, like even more so. Yeah,
there's a book by Rebecca Lowen, I believe, written about this, where it's like the creation of modern MIT and Stanford. Famously, MIT is funded by the CIA and the Ford Foundation, its Center for International Studies. This is where someone like Walt Rostow and Max Millikan developed their theories of modernization and development throughout the course of the 50s. I asked Chomsky about that once when I interviewed him. And he's like, all those people hated me. interestingly enough, the real head of that, Rostow, was Jewish. And actually, a lot of the people who were associated with Center for International Studies was Jewish, including a man named Ithiel de Solapool, who was the son of a Sephardic rabbi and who was also at MIT and overlapped with Chomsky for years and years and years. So there's also this Jewish intellectual history thing going on where a lot of these guys, what they did was they denied the particularities of the first half of the 20th century and embraced this sort of universalism, I think to some degree as a means of assimilation. But anyway, just to get back to Chomsky, he's a linguist, but he really becomes known in 1967 when the New York Review of Books reprints, most people don't know this, they reprint a piece that he wrote, a speech basically that he gave at a Harvard's Hillel, and that was published in its Mosaic magazine in 1966 called The Responsibility of Intellectuals, which was essentially Chomsky railing against the Cambridge set of intellectuals around Harvard. Again, really Walt Whitman Rostow at MIT and also Arthur Schlesinger Jr. at Harvard, and who in the early 60s were really embedded in the Kennedy administration, and some of them, particularly Rostow, remained embedded in the LBJ administration. And so the New York Review of Books back then was actually an edgy publication. It published this, and Chomsky's celebrity kind of gets going. He then becomes one of the most significant critics of U.S. foreign policy, publishing dozens of books. Many of those are like what I like call like fake books. They're kind of like conversations with Chomsky, you know, or like a speech by Chomsky that's republished. And I think really crucially, actually, he becomes a figure of sort of the underground counterculture in the 70s and the 80s. If you went to record stores in the 80s, they would have like bootlegs of Chomsky speeches. So he's like becomes this like countercultural pop culture figure to the degree where in that there's some silly movie about Viggo Mortensen where he plays like a family that goes off the grid, and I believe they celebrate Chomsky's birthday. He's mentioned by NoFX in a song. Bo Burnham mentions him in a song. And the show Community, the lefty poser's cat was named Chomsky. So he becomes like this figure. Like really, if anyone knows an anti-imperialist critic, if American does, 99.9% of the time, it's going to be Chomsky. So he sort of moves beyond the academy to become this pop culture figure because he's kind of like got this like stentorian look, this very prophet-like look, particularly more recently as he grew his beard and hair long. And he becomes this, I would say, probably the most famous anti-imperialist critic in the second half of the 20th century United States.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I just mentioned the New York Review thing. I mean, it is actually interesting if you look back, his period of writing for the New York Review was from 67 to like the, I think 73, basically, you know, the period where the Vietnam War is.
Yeah, not very long.
It starts winding down. And he was, you know, this is the period where the New York Review was at its most radical and, you know, publishing Molotov cocktails on their cover. Within that context, he was the most radical figure of that. And it's not a surprise that once the Vietnam War kind of winds down, that he's no longer welcome to the party because, the New York Review otherwise is still within the sort of, you know, Cold War liberal consensus. So I mean, he's an interesting sort of insider outsider figure that because of his great renown in linguistics, and he is like, you know, one of the major figures of the 20th century thought just for his work in linguistics, you know, you can't deny his credibility. And he has, you know, this intellectual cachet, but, you know, like he's also about as far as you can go and like not always totally welcome. I mean, I think there was a period, you know, especially in the 70s and 80s, where like, you know, like the one time you would see Chomsky in any publication was in the letters page, where you would write these letters basically documenting that, you know, stuff people were writing about him were false. But like otherwise, you know, like he's like, you know, like a liberal figure. Like he's as the one radical.
He's genuinely counterculture.
Yeah.
Like if you're into aliens, you probably also read Chomsky, right? It's like that sort of thing, which is like, it's very Gen X counterculture. It doesn't exist any longer. But he was like a legitimate figure. Like Mulder, I wouldn't be surprised if on the X-Files he mentions Chomsky. Yeah. I would bet anything he mentions Chomsky.
Yeah,
because that was sort of the world of that.
I
it was a cool world. I wish I was around for it.
And then the one sort of figure of that. And no, it's absolutely true that like in kind of, you know, used bookstores or You know, even head shops, you know, like Chomsky is the one foreign policy analyst you would see. So definitely he had a reach, and but also like some legitimacy within the mainstream, or at least they could never quite deny him. Although also, you know, like if you look at like his publication, even like he kind of goes from being published by Pantheon to being published by, you know, like more sort of like anarchist presses.
Small presses. Yeah. And but I think he does experience a resurgence after Iraq.
Absolutely.
Where he basically becomes like the doyen of the next generation. You have all these millennials who are like, I love Chomsky.
That's right.
You know, and one of those millennials, Nathan J. Robinson, friend of the pod, who started Current Affairs, wrote this recent book with him.
Yeah, that's right. So I think the in your review, like, you know, it has kind of like two parts. And the first part is just, you know, like basically laying out, you know, the Chomsky Robinson argument in this book, which is basically Chomsky's argument for his whole like life's work
career.
And so we can just like briefly give that and maybe emphasize its kind of like importance.
Yeah. I mean, so Chomsky is just, it's funny. To me, it's so standard, but like, it's like America is an empire. Despite what they say, America has actually done a lot of bad things around the world. And they're just like empires before them, and they're not exceptional. They're just like the British Empire, which was rapacious. They're like the Roman Empire, which was rapacious, and other empires throughout history. I was going to bring in the Ottoman, but I don't know if Chomsky ever actually refers to the Ottoman Empire. He's very Western focused. I think that the claims are correct. You know, like we've overthrown governments in Guatemala, in Iran. We've participated in assassination attempts throughout the global South. Chomsky was very big on criticizing U.S. foreign policy in Central America in the early 1980s. And, you know, the standard, what is now actually almost the standard historical understanding of what U.S. foreign policy was after World War II, it was effectively nakedly imperial. And Chomsky lays this out with explicit detail and sort of blunt, serious prose, which is his style. It really actually is a prophetic style. It's like very blunt. It's like, you have sinned and these are the sins and don't do that again. Because if you sin, God's wrath will be brought upon you. And he makes this argument and it's absolutely correct. And it's very influential and was historically really important for helping illuminate to many people what the United States actually did. And it wasn't the nation that defeated the Nazis. It was the nation that overthrew Mohammed and Mossadegh. And I think that's the big intervention that Chomsky made on the popular level. I actually don't know. I haven't gone through all of his books. I don't know if he's ever one to really do deep archival research. I think most of his claims are from newspapers and statements and more publicly available materials. So it's more of like a broad critique. It's not quite like he's not going into seeing exactly what John Foster, the negotiations that John Foster Dulles and Dwight Eisenhower had over whether to fund the East German uprising in 1953. That's not his métier. He's sort of looking at what happened in the news.
In the books in the 70s and 80s, a lot of what he was doing was basically popularizing the new left revisionist history. Historians like William Appleman Williams.
Gabriel Kolko, Appleman Williams.
Yeah, he often cites them. And you know, that was an important kind of body of work that was, you know, like not very familiar. And I think actually, I will actually say about his books on the Middle East, especially the, I think it's called The Fateful Triangle from the early 80s. It has the advantage, I wouldn't say deep archival work, but Chomsky knows Hebrew, obviously, and it cites a lot of sort of Hebrew reporting in newspapers, which you do not get.
Yeah, it's newspapers, right? A lot of his work is like a collation of like basically journalistic and reporting work, which is actually really useful. It's not like he has to be sitting in the archives all day. I think I guess I'm getting at is I think there's a little bit of a lack of depth to the work. But it's not. But that's not the purpose of it. So I don't want to be like, it's almost like when you read those reviews of yourself and you're like, well, why didn't you write a different book? Well, I didn't write a different book. This is the book I wrote. It's interesting. There's a lot of analytical heft to his linguistic work, and there's not that much analytical heft to his foreign policy work. It's more of a moral critique, which is correct. I should say, and important, and that's how you popularize something.
Yeah, no, that's right. That's right. I will only say, the reason I brought up the New Left revisionist historians is that, like, his arguments can be made in a more scholarly way, and were made by people like Gabriel Kolko and Walter Lefebvre.
Walter Lefebvre in particular.
Yeah, yeah.
He's great on it.
Yeah, yeah. And Chomsky did cite them. But I mean, but those were writers who were, you know, working within academia and addressing other academics and trying to convince other academics, whereas Chomsky was addressing a much broader public audience. And I think his impact, the one figure I could compare him to is his friend Howard Zinn, it is this fact that the reason it's so impactful is that there's a public myth that is, like, you know, within politics and within sort of like journalism, you know, like America is good. We're the virtuous nation, American exceptionalism. And then, you know, like Zinn comes along and says, well, you know, like, you know, we committed genocide against the Native Americans and we had slavery and we had, like, you know, almost world historical repression of the working class. And that has a big impact on a broad audience because, A, it's true, and it's you're actively refuting, you know, like
a liberal consensus,
a popular mythology. Yeah. And Chomsky, the same thing. Everyone could say it's obvious, like, you know, like the U.S. Empire has done these horrible things, but
it's obvious in 2025. It wasn't in 1975 to the same degree. Even after Vietnam, it was still the nation that beat the Nazis in a way that it just isn't any longer.
So it's like very necessary.
Well, that's a problem that when you publish a book in 2024.
This actually could get us to the second part of your argument, because I think, like, you know, Chomsky has this sort of, you know, this analysis, like, you know, this is like an empire that's done many evil things and it shouldn't be. And his basic response, and Robinson in his new book, you know, has the same basic analysis, is, you know, the response to this is, well, this happens in part because the public is brainwashed. There's this manufactured consent through the media. But if people know the facts, then they can come together and organize and protest and change the system.
It's an underpants gnome. I mean, I hate that. It's such a lame reference from 20 years ago, but it's really underpants gnome theory of political change. It's step one, learn, organize. Step two, ? Step three, change. You know, like, this is the big problem. I would actually say a lot of that generation of left-wing intellectual, I think they it was such a period of left-wing defeat. And I think we don't even appreciate the degree to which the liberal state wiped out the institutional left in the late 1940s. It really just decapitated a left that had been building for 50 years, using the excuse of the Cold War to do it. And then McCarthyism finished the job. And I think people need to appreciate that McCarthyism really comes after the liberal assault on the genuine left. And McCarthy actually attacks the liberals as well. And they're sort of brought in, basically being like, don't you even think of going back to the coalition of the 1930s. We'll get you. But I think it's a response to there being just no institutions, no genuine left-wing institutions. The new left institutions are... yeah, sure, some of them could be called meaningfully left, but they just pale in comparison to what was built in the 30s and the 40s, where you have hundreds, probably thousands of associations and institutions that are genuinely left-wing, linked to genuinely radical politics, not just the Communist Party, but also socialist politics, that are just wiped out, that in the late 1940s are literally just made illegal, effectively, and totally oppressed. And so you have a generation of intellectuals who I think are very, I don't even want to say naive about power. They almost don't even talk about it. Like, there's a moral critique, which ironically becomes a sort of almost Habermasian liberal critique. The notion that this information and this truth is going to be the first step in a revolutionary process that transforms society. They never talk about the revolutionary process. And I actually interviewed Nathan on my podcast. I'm like, so you've dealt with it. Like, what does he say? And he's like, Chomsky just waves off the question effectively. Like, when you ask Chomsky, like, what do you do? He's like, oh, I hate when people ask me that question. But that to me is the only important question, really, because the moral critique is now, I would argue, amongst people who care, a common knowledge. You know, that people understand what the United States did, if you care. Like, Anne Applebaum will post something and 1,000 people will respond, well, these are the actual things that define U.S. history, not whatever Anne Applebaum said. And so that's the moment we're at, where that the truth has become known, but it doesn't matter. And that is, I think, the problem of the left in the 2020s and going forward, in my view.
So I think your basic critique, and I don't know if you'll accept this term, but I think it's basically a structuralist critique. It is, you know, like what matters is sort of like power and institutions, and the, you know, like the amount of agency that individuals have against that is limited. Like, I think that, you know, like, I think that's a very sort of powerful critique. I worry that it's a little bit too like one-sided, and that there are kind of like exceptions, or there are ways in which even within these very powerful structures, they have to maneuver against public opinion, or they have to be aware of it. And I think, you know, the Vietnam War, which you discuss in your review, like maybe offers like an example of that, where, like, you know, one can arguable, you know, what was the impact of the anti-war movement? But I think it is the case that there was a combination of things. One was the anti-war movement. The other was the actual military failure of the United States in Vietnam that really, you know, became apparent with the Tet Offensive, that, you know, this program of counterinsurgency was not working. And you know, that the cost of this war outweighed any material benefit. And then the third factor is like dissent within the elite. That you had people who were coming out of, you know, Cold War liberalism, and, you know, had believed in the system and had supported the war, and then suddenly realized, hey, this is not working. You know, including, like, you know, like Robert McNamara, who it seems like from 1965 was aware that the U.S. could not win this war, you know, but kept on with it. But, you know, on a more significant level, so someone like Daniel Ellsberg, you know, who starts to leak the Pentagon Papers. So I think within that combination of, you know, like the U.S. empire beating military resistance that limits its ability to achieve its goals, you know, like a real mass uprising, you know, like, you know, admittedly it's of college students, you know, within the war against the draft, but also elite dissent, like that actually like did actually lead to a change in policy. Now, which is not what the anti-war movement necessarily wanted, but it's actually like, you know, like a significant turn.
Well, a couple of things. I think the anti-war movement's biggest effect in terms of the war and its biggest effect was ending the draft, or really not getting the draft renewed. But let's put that, it does shift strategy away from boots on the ground. And it does shift strategy towards the massive bombing campaigns that Nixon became famous for of the North, as well as Cambodia and Laos. So, I mean, that, I guess that's good for American boys not to die. But it's certainly not transformational.
Well, no, it's sort of transformational, like, in the sense that the early Cold War, both Korea and Vietnam, like the Americans
are mass wars.
Yeah. Mass wars.
So what it
ends the age of mass wars.
There's this ironic, allowing the U.S. empire to basically do what it does because the bourgeoisie no longer fights its wars. But it does seem when it terms a couple of things. The strongest argument, I think, in favor of public opinion shaping foreign policy is LBJ's decision to escalate across 64 and 65, which does seem to have been taken. Fred Loganthal argues this in his book, Choosing War, primarily for domestic electoral reasons. So that there were fears about the electoral fate of the Democratic Party, which I guess you could sort of squint at as being about public opinion, although it's really not quite the same thing. And that was one of the major reasons, Loganthal argues, and I think has become kind of the status quo consensus. Why did LBJ escalate? It's a lot to do with electoral politics. But when we're talking about the effect of the anti-war movement, I think it was memorialized in the 70s and the 80s by boomers as being one of the major reasons that the war came to an end. And it's just not true. It does seem that the major reason that the war came to the end is because people within Nixon's coalition wanted to. The two major reasons is that they thought it was a distraction from great power politics. So you have a similar thing happening right now in the Middle East. They're like, why are we wasting time on Vietnam? We need to talk about China. You get Nixon's opening to China, and we need to talk about the Soviet Union. You get the beginnings of detente. And the other reason is that there were fiscal conservatives within the Nixon coalition who just thought this was costing too much stamp money, and they weren't military Keynesians. So you have also what happens in the early 1970s is Nixon basically ends the Bretton Woods system, and he moves away from the military Keynesianism. That defined American politics during the height of the Fordist era in the 50s and the 60s. towards edging towards the neoliberalism that's then pushed forward by Carter and really embraced by Reagan. And just at least the historical work done on this does suggest that those were much more significant causal reasons as to why the United States ended the war in Vietnam. This is not to say that public opinion was not a factor. It was one of a concatenation of factors, though if a historian's job is to establish causal hierarchies, it's not at the top of the list of causal reasons why the United States changed the war. And just one more thing, I just want to say, the important point that I would make is that I don't think public opinion has ever been a driver of U.S. foreign policy.
Yeah, no.
Throughout the nation's history, and really not since World War II. So I think we have this strange, we conceive of this country as a mass democracy, and it's just not. It's just not a country in which public opinion, when it comes to foreign policy, my sense is it's in other research areas, issue areas too, but let's just limit it to foreign policy. When it comes to foreign policy, the public is just not the driver, and it never has been. And there's manifold instances of that.
Although, I mean, I don't think like Chomsky himself would argue that public opinion has ever driven foreign policy.
Well, then it's confused. Yeah. This is the problem, right? Like Chomsky, you point to it, then okay, then it's a confused, and this is what I talked to Nathan about, because Chomsky, as you said, is a little ill at this point. And then when you bring it up to Chomsky, I mean, like I didn't put this in the piece, I had it originally, but like Chomsky, he's also referring to like things that are like several decades out of date. Like he refers to like the field of diplomatic history in a way that hasn't been true since 1985. So I think there was like a limit on this. He reached almost a wall in his thought and kind of kept on repeat, because the moral critique is correct. So you could kind of like, there are always new examples of it. But he never, when you think about the Gulf War, you think about Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, there's a million examples that Chomsky could point to. But when it came to this question of power, and it came to this question of knowledge, I just think he hasn't been correct on that in decades.
Yeah, well, I don't think the argument for like sort of mass protest, and I think that's actually an important conversation to have, because it's clear that mass protest, and we see this with Gaza as well, have not had the impact that one would want them to have. And so one has to think about like, how does one actually change this horrible killing machine? But I will say that, like, you know, on Chomsky's behalf, like I would never say that public opinion has driven American foreign policy, but I think it's put limits on what America can do, or it's forced these strategists to restructure how they proceed. And as you say, sometimes in bad ways. I mean, like, you know, like instead of boots on the ground, bombing. And I think we saw that with Iraq as well, like in some ways that the unpopularity of all the body bags coming home, like led to the drone wars, right?
Yeah, now just bomb the shit out of everyone. Like Obama, now kids in Waziristan can't exit their houses without having a nervous breakdown. You know, it's really grim stuff.
It's absolutely grim and depressing. But it is the case that I think, like at some level, the awareness, the American elite that's carrying out this foreign policy do have some awareness that like these policies aren't popular. You always need to have propaganda to sell them. You always have to be making Hollywood movies like Top Gun to like, you know, like, and you have to always have to make sure that journalism is filled with CIA assets who will repeat their party line. So I mean, there is a sense in which public opinion, as you say, is not the main factor, but is a factor. I mean, the other thing I would point to is like, why did
it's not a drive? The way I would put it, it doesn't drive.
No, it doesn't drive. No.
That's what I think is the crucial thing. And in a democracy, it's supposed to at least be in the car.
Yeah. But I don't think like, yeah, Chomsky would see America as a democracy, or, you know, like it's a very limited one.
But he's confused. I mean, he says different things at different. I mean, because so much of the Chomsky work are like talks, right? And so, like, when you're doing this type of oral communication that really does consist, like, it really does comprise a lot of the Chomsky corpus, there's a lot of like contradictory statements and like, this matters, this doesn't matter, oh wait, it's the most important thing, oh wait, it's not. And then when like I would direct people to my interview with Nathan, because like we really like zero in on this, and it's pretty interesting.
I wouldn't deny that these contradictions are here, but I just want to like point out ways in which, even if, you know, like the public protests can never be the driving force, you know, within this like highly hierarchical structured society, you know, like they have been a factor. And yeah, the other thing I would point is like why did Reagan have to do Iran-Contra, you know, if not for the fact that, you know, there was like such an opposition that, you know, his policies had to be covert. But having said that, no, I mean, I do agree with your broad critique that, you know, you have this like national security structure, which has been incredibly powerful and, you know, like entrenched. In ways, despite the fact, and as you say, like public opinion doesn't really matter in the sense that, you know, we now have a generation that doesn't believe in any of the lies. It does not has not been bought into manufactured consent. And if, you know, like you look at people, I think there's a poll showing people under like 30 basically believe the United States is, you know, a dying empire run by bad people.
Well, unfortunately, that's okay. I really wanted that to be true, but the poll doesn't ask that. That basically Semaphore interviewed the guy who did it, and that's his words. Basically, Jeet, it's so funny because I've been like digging deep into this. Basically, there has never been a poll done that just asks, is the United States an empire? Like, I just want someone to do that poll and just ask Americans, is the U.S. an empire? And there's always like global leader or like bullshit terms, but there's never been a poll done. So there's actually like there's some ambiguity about what Americans actually think. I'm trying to get the Quincy Institute to do it. Just pay for someone to be like, is the U.S. an empire? Ask 20,000 Americans and then see what they say. But unfortunately, that quote is not related to the actual poll.
Yeah, but there's a lot of other evidence that, you know, there's just not the buy-in for the idea of
for sure.
American
when you ask questions about global, basically the two things that are always asked is global leader and active participant in world affairs. And there's been steep declines. Basically, if you're over 65, you really believe in it. And if you're under 35, you really don't.
Yeah, well, which I would actually say, like, you know, like you could put a Chomsky spin on that. The people over 65 came of the era of manufactured consent when there was like a massive media investment. And you basically had three TV channels and a few newspapers. And the people like, you know, like under 40 are getting everything from social media a different information stream. But I mean, from your analysis, and I basically agree with that, like this shift in public opinion or this disbelief in empire, this is like people, this like lack of buy-in from the younger generation into the imperial project is not having the effect that one would wish it to have, right? Because like America is not a democracy. It's a, you know, like,
I think there's two reasons. Correct. America's not a democracy. And two, Americans don't fight their wars. I mean, this is the biggest shift. It's like in the last half century, the bourgeoisie does not fight the wars. So fight the war. I mean, you could be anti-Iraq, but like I was anti-Iraq. Did it matter? I was at fucking college and then graduate school. You know, I was never at risk of going to the front lines. So like there was going to be a limit on the political action that one would do in order to stop the Iraq war. And that's just a brute fact of politics, I think.
Yeah. No, I think that's right. Although I think that there is like, you know, one sees this with the sort of Trump phenomenon, there is a kind of, you know, belief that like disengagement from the wider world, no longer belief that like it's very important for America to be involved with places like Ukraine or even the Middle East. And, you know, like a real desire to have like politics be focused on domestic repair. Like, I think that's a broad shift across the political spectrum, and except among the sort of, you know, like leaders of the Democratic Party and the national security ghouls who actually control everything. Again, I mean, this is perhaps to like it's worth thinking out like why this, you know, disillusionment with empire hasn't translated into actual policy shifts.
And it's the structure of the state. I mean, this is what my scholarly work. I mean, there was a very – and this is the ironies of modern liberalism. What I call – I think I might have even sent you this essay on Cold War liberalism. But I call the Second New Deal this thing in the 1940s where they basically took the ideas of the domestic New Deal. You're going to create agencies to rationally manage politics and created them for foreign policy. These institutions like the National Security Council, the Central Intelligence Agency, the Department of Defense, the National Economic Council. So you have the creation of these state institutions, which are executive branch institutions, which are totally disconnected from public opinion and Congress. Like, how does Henry Kissinger? People are talking about Elon Musk as unelected, unconfirmed official. How do you think Henry Kissinger got in? Through the National Security Council, which unelected and, you know, unconfirmed.
Actually, Nixon was very similar to Trump in the sense that he didn't want his cabinet or, you know, like the confirmed or Congress to have any say in foreign policy. He and Kissinger were like trying to like, you know, have a state within a state.
Yeah, I mean, look at LBJ. I mean, LBJ is not going. I mean, the Gulf of Tonkin resolutions is a lie. Based on a lie. So you have that. But then even what gets really more complex is that you have these parastatal groups when it comes to foreign policy. You have these think tanks, which, you know, their major contract is the government, but they're not subject. They're not treated as a public institution. You have academic research centers like at Harvard that, you know, these people, they actually develop the ideas and do the research for foreign policy. They're not subject to any form of democratic accountability. So you have these basically what a Foucauldian would call like a technostructure that is totally disconnected from any sort of popular will. So it makes it very difficult to even conceive of how one would go around changing this sort of decentered capillary matrix that makes foreign policy that they don't give a shit about a mass protest. Look at Iraq. In the run-up to Iraq War, they had the biggest mass protest in history. Didn't matter a lick. Did not matter at all. So that's something that I think the left needs to confront instead of romanticizing tactics that no longer work.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. Although, I mean, I actually also think the failure of Iraq did like, you know, have sort of political consequences. You know, for better or worse, you wouldn't have had either Obama or I mean, the Bush family is kind of like totally discredited within the Republican Party.
To the degree that they're getting rid of PEPFAR, I mean, that's what's really interesting. The one thing that like that people always pointed to as the great achievement of the Republicans, PEPFAR, they're getting rid of it. It's wild. It's a totally different Republican Party.
Yeah, no, which actually ties in with like the sort of like larger argument. I mean, I do think that older Republican Party and the Democratic Party still like believes in, you know, selling empire through hegemony, through buy-in, like, you know, doing good works, you know, like
selling hegemony through hegemony.
Yeah, it's about selling. Selling it by with the idea that like we're it's what's good for America is good for the world, and we're a positive force, and like believing in the idealism on some level, right? And like what Trump is basically saying, no, like Trump is like, to me, a bizarre old Noam Chomsky. He's like, no, we're just an empire. We're just in it to get the minerals and the oil. And, you know, like, if we do anything else, if we actually like try to help people, then we're suckers. And this is actually
just very quickly, someone on Twitter tweeted, oh, like people are mad at Trump. Don't you know that you're supposed to talk about human rights while you send the bombs?
That's right. Yeah.
And that's like the cynical take on it. And there's the truth
there. Yeah, no. And this is why like Trump is so hated by the blob and the national security elite, because like, you know, like he's actually like makes the Chomsky critique like very apparent, right? Like, you don't need to even read Chomsky's book. Like, oh, this is an empire, you know, crudely interested in plunder, pure and simple. And for the class of people that are still interested in, you know, like selling empire, who want to sell it to themselves, they want to themselves feel like we're good people. What we're doing is for the good of the planet, even though we get our hands dirty with some nasty wars. Trump destroys those illusions, which I think itself could have interesting political implications. But I mean, to me, like, it is that Democrat. I mean, we saw this with the you know, Trump speech, and then the response by Alisa Slotkin.
That was so. I'm never voting for that party. I mean, it's wild. Like they have lost my vote.
Yeah, I don't know. Who basically, you know, tried to revive this kind of, you know, Cold War liberalism. You know, praise Ronald Reagan. I'm glad Ronald Reagan was president, not Donald Trump. But like, if we're going to get changed, like, it seems to me like that is a class that has to be overthrown. Like, if you could somehow change the Democratic Party so that, you know, the actual views of Democratic Party voters, you know, which is very skeptical towards a lot of these wars and interventions, was the norm, and that you did not have these national security former CIA ghouls like being the face of the party, then we could have fun times. we could have something interesting happening. But I mean, yeah, we could. This is for another debate. But I mean, the question is that plausible? Is there some way to, you know, change the structure of this party?
TBD. I guess we'll have to see. The only way people will know is if they subscribe to American Prestige at AmericanPrestigePod.com.
Yeah, no, this is a conversation we could continue, but I want to thank Danny once again for a great talk.
Check engine light on? Take the guesswork out of your check engine light with O'Reilly Veriscan. It's free. Ask for O'Reilly Veriscan today.
Oh, oh.